The darkness was nearly perfect. Arb was on the other side of the ship and shed no light here. A new moon, though, was swinging up through the cluttered horizon of the nearest shock piston, strewing faint light by which we cut ourselves apart and sorted ourselves out. Our magnetic boot soles stuck faintly to the icosahedron, a rubble of nickel and iron. Moving like a man with gum on the soles of his shoes, Saman made the rounds and checked our connections to the rope wire. "This facet will remain in darkness for another 20 minutes, Jessery informed us, after which we have to move to that one. I supposed he was pointing at one of the three shock pistons that made up our local horizon, but I couldn't see him. As the Dobbin Ernud revolved around Arb, the Terminator, the dividing line between the sunlit and shaded halves of the icosahedron, crept around it. On any given facet, sunrise or sunset would be explosively sudden. We'd better not get caught in the open when it happened, because the citadel-like complexes that loomed over the 12 vertices had clear views over the surrounding facets.
According to my equipment, announced Fra Gratho, we did not get illuminated by any short-range radar. They simply don't have it turned on, said Leo. But sooner or later, they'll probably notice the Monufiques that Fra Jad cut loose, or the coal black mirror, and then they'll go to a higher state of alert. So, which way to the world burner?
Follow me, said
Fra Osa, and started walking. If walking was the right word for such a clumsy style of locomotion. I'd like to say we moved as drunks, but it would be an insult to every sloshed Fra who had staggered back to his cell in the dark. Much of our 20 minutes of darkness was burned moving the first couple of 100 feet. After that, though, we learned, if not what to do, then at least what not to do, and reached the nearest horizon with a few minutes' darkness to spare. The shock piston was like a pipeline half buried in the rubble, but reinforced with fin-like trusses to prevent it from buckling like a straw when it was under load. At its ends, about a mile away in either direction, it swelled like the end of a bone and developed into a heavy steel knuckle. 5 such knuckles, coming together from different directions, formed the base of each vertex. Each vertex was different, but in general, they had been cobbled together from a mess of domes, cylinders, gridwork, and antennae. Extravagant bouquets of silver parabolic horns flourished from their tops, waiting for their turn to gaze into our sun and steal some of our light. The triangular rubble field across which we'd been walking didn't butt up hard against the shock piston, because there had to be some give in the system. A shock absorber that had been, in effect, welded to a stiff triangular plate all along its length would not be able to function. Instead, the facet stopped 10 feet short of the truss work that enshrouded the shock and was sewn to it by a system of cables that zigzagged over pulleys. At a glance, it looked awfully complicated and made me think of sailboats, not starships. But since the Ernudans had been building such things for 1,000 years, I guessed they had come up with a way to make it work. Light shone up from the chasm below. As we neared it, we slowed, bent forward, and gazed into the interior of the icosahedron, a volume of some 23 cubic miles, softly illuminated by sunlight slitting in through other such gaps and scattering from the icosahedron's inner walls and the 16 orbs. It was all as we'd seen it rendered on the model, but of course to see it in person was altogether different. The view was dominated by the nearest of the orbs, swinging by as fast as the second hand on a clock, helpfully painted with a huge numeral in the Ernudan writing system. I had learned enough of this to translate it as number 5. Orb 5 housed high-ranking Troans. All of my instincts told me to fear the jump across the gap, because if I fell in, I would drop for some vast distance before getting splattered on a rotating orb. But of course, there was no gravity here. No down. Nothing to fall into. Osa went first, launching himself across the gap and getting himself established on the struts that lent strength to the shock piston. Vey was the last on the line. Once we'd all made it over, we hand-over-handed our way across the shock out of concern that the snapping of our magnetic boots against its steel would create an obvious acoustical signature. There was a dizzy moment when our settled conception of up and down was challenged by the next facet swinging into view, defining a new level and a new horizon. Then we got used to it and floated across another gap, using the same procedure as before. This was perhaps an overly cautious way to travel 10 feet through space, but if we all did it at once and jumped too hard, we might drift away. Sun was striking the struts we had just passed over as we planted our feet on the next facet of the icosahedron, where we could be assured of a few hours' darkness. This was more time than we needed, or to speak truthfully, it was more than we had, since we only had an hour's oxygen remaining and the tender was gone. 2 miles away, directly across the facet, was a hydrogen bomb the size of a 6-story office building. It was essentially egg-shaped, but like a beetle caught in spider's webbing, its form was blurred by a fantastic tangle of strutwork and plumbing connecting it to the Vertex Citadel. Indeed, that whole vertex appeared to have no practical use other than to serve as a support base for the world burner. Even if it hadn't been so enormous, it would have been a difficult thing to miss, because it was all lit up. Lit up for the benefit of 100 people in spacesuits clambering around on it.
Do you think they're getting ready to launch it?
Arcibald asked.
I don't think they're giving it a new paint job, Jessery said.
Very well,
Leo said. I didn't know who he was speaking to or what he was giving his assent to. A click on the line suggested that someone had just jacked out.